happy to be here, particularly on this very special occasion. 70th birthday of John. But there's some other point to celebrate. I met John in 1976 in Pisa. So subtract the numbers and you see this is half time of lifetime, exactly half time of our acquaintance and collaboration. And as you see, we still talk to each other and still work. There's lots of things to do, again, still not left. We are not finished, right, John? Yeah. So we are in Berkeley this spring, and we met some other two senior guys, well, at least one senior, Barry Mazur and Carl Rubin, and from different subjects, as you can imagine. But they had some interesting questions to ask, and they somehow addressed the right people to John and myself. They needed some results about that later on I learned they needed for the application to estimate the two Selmer rank, you know, etc. So they need some results, which somebody probably gave them a hint that we are adequate people to be asked. So we took it seriously, the challenge, and guess what? We did solve the problem. Yeah, so that's what I'm going to talk about today, about the spin of prime ideals. This is somewhat a new concept, but not exactly. We use that word for other things that is superficially reminiscent to the spin I'm going to talk today. So that's how they probably thought that we are the right people to be asked. And so let me slowly prepare you for the main results. Lots of definitions have to be first, you know, mentioned. And so what is the spin, right? We decided not to work in full maximum generality, but in considerable generality in order to even more than actually was needed for application. But so today also, like in the paper, I will only talk about cases where the spin, the concept, looks most natural. Right. Not, of course, missing applications. Right. So please have in mind that certain things could be generalized pretty straightforward. Yeah. So let's take number field K. Oh, I have some gadget here, right? That's what? All right, that's, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so number field K, finite extension. Let's say of degree n, the extension of Q, and assume it's Galois, and also for convenience, but would be very essential property, it's also totally real, so it has all this embedding, n embedding into real, a field of real numbers. And one other thing, technical but extremely useful, what we are doing is U is the group of units. And U plus is the totally positive. The U itself is a just group of units. U plus is totally positive, totally real. Oh, yeah. Okay. Totally positive, not totally real. Yeah. Okay. I can't change in the computer. Yeah. Yeah. Totally positive units, and U square is the group of squares of units, and we assume they are equal. So. A unit is totally positive if and only if it's a square. Yeah, so that's a property that you may argue doesn't happen often, but yes, it does happen often, and very important actually case. And so we decided also to give some examples, so you be sure that we are not talking about empty sets. Yeah, there are nice theorems about empty sets, but not here. Not this one, right? So One example is this cubic number field that was considered by Shank in 74. You take a root of this cubic polynomial. M is just any parameter, integer, rational integer, and K is just that field by extension of that by this root. And you can prove, not difficult actually, this is, you know, this is the totally real extension Galois, and of course then it's cyclic and have square of the discriminant, must be square as a characterization of such extensions. So this is just one example. The fact that not so easy is to prove that U plus is equal to U square, but you have to take my word, it is the case.
Yeah. Isn't it true in the pizza component, the totally real subfield of the pizza component
field? Say it again?
The totally real subfield of the pizza component field.
That's, well, I would mention this case, that's right. Yeah, the maximal real subfield of a circle tonic, that would be, yeah, right. Yeah. I will, this come out later in other example. Pardon?
That's Kummer's theorem, I think, in that case.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. Not Kummer, Kummer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. All right, yeah. Okay, so this is just an example. But there are, of course, other things like quintic field by Lemmer. You know? I can't remember this. You have to write it down. It's complicated. I think that's also satisfy all the conditions. I'm saying that this, some of these conditions are not that easy to prove, by the way. But, you know, the other co-authors, Maisel and Rubin, that's for them, it's just kid stuff, you know. But so they provided proofs of these properties for these fields. Yes, Anika?
Yeah, we can use the case M equals
2. Aha, for the cubic, you mean? Yeah, right. It's a very famous, this very popular case, actually. Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah, this one, the cubic one. Yeah. All right, so this is just example. And now, before I go to spin, I have to do something that you may be familiar, maybe not. What is the quadratic residue symbol? This is in the field, not it's a generalization or analog of the Jacobi symbol, but you have to be very cautious. Definitions really are tricky and very careful about it when you talk about things in the number field. So, O means the ring of integers of the field K, and let's take an ideal, of course, integral ideal, a non-zero integral ideal, and assume it's odd, meaning what? It's coprime with 2, right? Yeah, so okay. And alpha is an element of the ring, integer, and for this alpha and Q, we define the symbol. If Q is factored into R primes, not necessarily distinct, then the symbol is the product of the symbols when the denominator is a prime. And what is now for the prime is, if alpha is not divisible by P, then it's 1 or minus 1 according to, can you guess easily, whether alpha is a square or not a square modulo P in the field, in the ring of integers, right? And if P does divide alpha, then we set the symbol to be 0. And it enjoys the symbol very much similar properties as the classical, you know, Jacobi symbol. It is multiplicative in both in alpha and in Q, but Q is by definition, periodicity in alpha modulo Q, and most important and will be very critical property here is the reciprocity law, which looks similar way, like the Gauss reciprocity law or whatever Jacobi in symbol, but you have to be very cautious about the many things. We don't define the symbol when the denominator is even. Have this in mind all the time. This is really tricky, and even guys are really troublemakers here. Yeah, right, yeah. So, but of course, avoid this means we have to go around in many times in situations that we have to deal with even numbers. I mean, it's not just a free meal. We just don't define it, you know. It's just, yeah. But it's better not to define than having any confusion. Yeah, so the symbol alpha over Q is never defined when Q is not odd.
So alpha and beta are elements.
Alpha, right. Now, so alpha over beta, of course, I was brief in writing, so beta means integral, the principal idea generated by beta. Right, that's the extension here. Yeah.
Right.
Alpha over beta means alpha over the ideal generated by beta. Okay, and so you see that the choice of generator doesn't matter because the congruence is modulo beta, whether you change by unit or not doesn't matter. But of course, if you change numerator by unit, then differs tremendously. Yeah, so be careful about that, right? You see, now I'm just very quick, not doing the whole survey of basic algebraic number theory. So the reciprocity is like here, this alpha of beta equal to beta over alpha, and alpha beta odd, and there is some plus minus sign in front of it, and you better be specifying there, otherwise it is nothing interesting. Right? So this is a product of local Hilbert symbols, P in infinity place, which have n of these, and also some factors of two. Right, the Hilbert symbol is easily understood, at least here for the quadratic symbol, it's just a number of this question of whether the symbol alpha beta over P, it's 1 or minus 1, whether this ternary quadratic form has a solution in the local field or not. You know what I mean, alpha x squared plus beta y squared minus x squared equal to 0. So that's simple, but if it was n power as a symbol, there are problems there. Not only that the field has to have the roots of unity, but also there are lots of problems of determining explicitly that symbol. You know, we don't need it explicit sometimes. But here it's pretty easy, pretty relatively easy. We suffer tremendously with lots of technical lemmas, which, to handle this sign properly, and I will not show it in the lecture. But yeah, okay, so this is the symbol, and that's what the spin is. Aha. So you take a Galois group and fix one of these automorphisms, let's say sigma, and now we define the spin when sigma is fixed. So it depends on sigma, and I'll mention later what happens if I change sigma. Sigma is fixed for us, okay? And I define the spin of an ideal. And we can define, we tried this, but then we gave up, define for every ideal, but for simplicity and for applications, we just need only for the principal ideal. So I define spin only for principal ideals. I'm not assuming the class number is 1. Better not, because otherwise there'd be not so many examples. But we define the spin only for the principal ideals. Yes. Wait. Yes. Yeah. It says. And I will even repeat that. Yeah. I can give you my glasses when I see this. Wait, Andrew. I know you know this stuff. Okay. So I said we could define a little bit artificially, spin of any ideal by fixing representatives of classes and blah 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 like this, but forget it, it's just not worth of effort. So we define the spin only for the principal ideal. Well, principal ideal is generated by element of a field of a ring, which one you choose, right? So you take first of all totally positive, one, and then spin is defined as the quadratic symbol alpha over A sigma. So A sigma is the action of sigma on the ideal A. So you change the ideal by taking conjugate ideal, by that sigma that you chose from the once and for all from the Galois group, and that is spins. So it takes values plus minus 1 if these guys are coprime, or 0 otherwise. Of course, yes, Valentin. Oh yeah, that's so scared. You're looking so right. Okay, so that's the spin, and what I can say, it's well defined because alpha is chosen up to a unit, but after the square of the unit because of totally positive alpha, and totally positive units are squares, so the symbol does not change value if I change my alpha. So it's well defined. Andrew, am I right? Yeah, me too. Yeah, okay. So, fine. So, right? So that's the spin. And before I run out of time, better say results first and then continue talking. Right? Yeah. Or arguing, actually. Not talking. Okay. So our main interest is to estimate the sum over prime ideals, principal prime ideals, and of spin. We would like to see how the spin is distributed. Now, plus minus one, you know, is there any cancellation or not over there? You see why, of course, it's motivated by some results later on applications. Pardon me? Oh, you are not. Yes, yes, because of the U plus is U square. Yeah. Every pattern would be, the index is 2 to the power n of this, of the group of units. Yeah. Such a representative, totally positive, yeah. Yeah. So by the way, it's very convenient for other reasons that the concept of class group or class is very simple, whether it's in white sense or in standard sense, the same thing. You know, the equivalence of ideas. But anticipating your next questions, Andrew, let me tell you that there is indeed a huge gymnastic here, which I've not shown during the talk. You know, how to choose, how to the transition from ideas to representatives is a huge problem. And so the choice of a proper fundamental domain is very essential, and it's a beautiful, fantastic construction by Shintani, which we are using. But I think I don't have time to mention this thing at all. But it's really beautiful. Even Barry Major said it was beautiful. So, right, yeah. So, but it's very elegant choice by Shintani, his famous paper of Shintani when he was in the fantastic, you know, fundamental domain. If maybe later on, you know, we can talk about this after the talk. Yeah. Yes, right now, and I'll be moving that later, when if time permits, yeah. But right now it's fixed, so some notation does not even display it. And of course, I'll show you some catch, you know, some choices are terrible. You know, like sigma equal to identity, right? Yeah, or even worse, even more less obvious, involution. If sigma is involution, talk about that. Okay. Right now, be patient, just... Yeah, read my lips. Okay. So the goal is to estimate some of the principal prime ideals, and we order them according to the norm, right? And of spin. And as you can imagine, we want to prove that it's small. That means due to the cancellation, the variation, the sign of the spin. Yeah, I think it's a good terminology. Spin, right? It's really spinning here. Yeah. Yeah, plus minus one. Right. Okay. So before I go further explanation what happens in the work, let me say what it is really powered by, you are not surprised, by estimate for short character sums, real character sums. And unfortunately, we can't have complete unconditional results for any degree n. But we do have, in the most important case of cubic field, when n is equal to 3, because of Burgess. So Burgess again and again. You know, Burgess is absolutely here vital. That's the whole analytic part of the work is powered by estimation for the character sums. So, but we nothing else is an obstruction here to deal with any degree except for the character sum. So why not just to make a conjecture and then follow completely, you know, present in a full generality. So we do full generality, but we need conjecture when n is larger than 3, and call it Cn. So it's you can read it here, right? You know, it says that we have some cancellation character sums of certain lengths, not too short, not too long, and this is phrased in that way because we hope that there is a chance of proving such things in the future. It's, of course, it follows from, it doesn't follow even from Riemann hypothesis. Why? No. Andrew, you know everything, so. So why it doesn't follow from Riemann hypothesis? Pardon me? That's right, yeah. Yeah, Roman, absolutely, yeah, good school. Where you came from? So, no, because it's very short in segments, and for short, in the, only for the initial segment, you know, Riemann hypothesis would give it to you. So really, Burgess, you have to really appreciate Burgess is more than has certain features that can't be even established by Riemann hypothesis. Anyway, so this is innocent conjecture here, CN, and take my word that for n equal to 3, use Burgess bound, and give you this estimation with 1 over 48, so you have an idea that we have some result, some condition. This is the condition because we want to cover all the degrees of the fields, but we are stuck with this character sum. Yeah, but not for cubic, yeah. All right, so having this, now we have a main result. So here's the theorem 1. Assume the degree is at least 3. Well, you see later why it fails for quadratic, because quadratic is only involution in the Galois group, and that really, the whole argument will fail for involution. Okay, and assume this is cyclic, so sigma is chosen as a generator of the Galois group. Well, if it's cubic, it's just if it's Galois, then. Back? Yeah.
In the end that you have there, I think it's the order of the character?
No, it's the degree of the field.
Oh, the degree of the field.
Yeah, and also the variable of summation. Right, we have 26 characters only to play with. Yeah. More than that?
More in the room.
Right. Oh, those characters, you're watching, okay, yeah, they're not real, yeah. Okay, so yeah. Maybe primitive. All right. So, okay. Now, forward. Yeah. Right. So this is the main result. So indeed, we proved in this situation that n is at least 3 and sigma is generator. So I'm assuming the extension is cyclic, automatically, right? Then, of course, such sigma is not involution because n is at least 3. Right? So we get cancellation. Cancellation to the extent we have power saving of x. You know. And we determined that nicely in terms of n, the degree of the field, this exponent, is getting worse and worse when the degree is larger, but who cares? It's just absolute constant there if n is fixed, like 3. And for 3, we get unconditionally by Burgess bound 1 over 10,000. Yeah, right? Yes, Enrico? Yeah, 12n plus 1 times n. Same concern was by Barry. He said we should type it differently. Remember this, John?
Yeah, I think that no, he didn't like the other way we typed.
Yeah.
He didn't like the slash.
The slash, yeah.
Right.
Really? We better check it then. I can't do often with that. It's possible that we goofed. No, I tell you now. I copied wrongly. This is different exponent. I'm sorry. This is a different exponent here. Yeah. I copied that wrongly. Just by copying it wrong. This is. So there is exponent, okay? Yeah. So nu is the delta. Yeah, because delta over, and you don't know where the delta is. Exactly. So that's not 1 over, it's delta over that. Okay, that's how it's small. Yeah, so it's typo. Yeah. Delta over 12n plus 1 plus 1. Yeah. Yeah.
Delta is going to control
Delta is coming from the conjecture Cn, and for n equal to 3 is from Berger's, right? It's very small, but positive constant. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, that's delta over, right. Okay, so this is unconditional result. And the one thing before we go further, you know, was that Barry Major was Carl Rubin really needed that to give example what they were doing about Selmer group. I mean, Carl Rubin spent his lifetime, I think, on estimating the rank of two Selmer group, and a wonderful paper in Invenciones recently. You know, they found that they could actually even write a formula of this Carl Rubin. I don't know exactly if Major was involved. You know, for this rank and this in terms of the spin. Well, the terminology came later. So they were hoping that this kind of object that what we call spin is a Chebotarev type. That is to say that, you know, there is some multiplicativity there, take L function, and you know, and here's the expert of Chebotarev, and get the result. But so one of the initial question was not actually to prove things like that, but just to investigate whether this is of Chebotarev type. And when we claim that we can probably save a power of x, so no way, God is not that generous to give us quasi-Riemann hypothesis. So it is psychologically disproving that this is a Chebotarev type, that the associated L function with the spin would not have Euler product. And that's a blessing for us and problem for them, you know. Like that, yeah. So we got a power saving. Yeah, well, I tell you, I mean, I have too many sins to get this gift for free. Right. Right. So that's what that was one of exciting, you know, moments of conversation, cooperation, like that. It's a really beautiful time we had in Berkeley working for us there. You know, and speculating, trying to get things until, and then the things were done essentially in Berkeley, but took 4 months to massage it, and more than that. Yeah, so yeah, and it's all written, you know, it's done, it's here. If you don't, yeah, Andrew, it's here, but I can't tell you, I can't give it to you now, because we still are. We have to have agreement of 4-3 others. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so this is the main result, and you can feel what was behind to investigate it. Now, one of the applications that Carl gave us was this, you know, cubic elliptic curve. This particular one as an example, this is full additive reduction here. Like, take the two division points of the curve and the field which is extension by this point, and this is happens to be cubic, and it's a maximal real subfield of Q of roots of unity, and it's Galois of cubic cyclic and has class number 1, and the roots satisfy the condition that we say U plus is U square, so all the conditions are satisfied. And again, now let me emphasize, verification of that is not that easy. There's some gymnastic that Carl Rubin could do it overnight. We only just could follow and see what he is saying. It's not that easy. But anyway, he did it. Right. And okay. And why that particularity curve? Because as an example, right? He was able to estimate to give an exact formula for the two Selmer group, the rank of it, and the dimension, this is, you know, this is a vector space over F2, right? So the dimension of F2 of the Selmer group, and it's equal of E twisted by P, the quadratic twist with P quadratic twist of it. So the formula is 2 plus the spin, which is then 3 or 1, so it's not constant, but has the same parity. You probably are very familiar with this. Right, you know, and the question is, well, you know, how often is this 3? How often is 1? right? And because of the theorem 1, it says half of the time is 3, half of the time is 1. And the two-sigma group is very important for estimating the rank of Moore veil, right? That's typical, you know, tool these days, right? To estimate the what are you laughing? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. Anyway, so it's very important, I think, application, even though it doesn't belong to our territory. It's just Rubin and Berenazer, but that's the motivation, which I think is fine enough to spend 7 months working on the problem. Okay. So okay, I mean, P must be special. I mean, speed's completely there, and has to be. Oh yeah, I have to really say that because that's unfair. You know, the P must be generated by pi, constant to 1 mod 4. So we actually we need Ray class ideals for theorem 1 to cover this 1 mod 4. But generalization is pretty obvious. And we still contemplate maybe you should include in the paper the generalization, but who knows? Yeah. Okay, so now, why does it work? What's the beef? Where's the beef, you know? In the whole thing? Why we could get power saving of X in estimation of sums of the spin? Because the spin is not multiplicative. If you take actually, in my presentation, only presentation, not in the paper, but in the presentation, for simplicity, that assume the class number is 1. Of course, we are not assuming the paper, but it's really lots of mess there, you know, to handle that case in general. So let class number be 1. So every idea is principal. Take A and B, two ideas, alpha and beta, totally positive generators, and I and B are odd. So the spin happens. Okay, the spin of the product is not the product of the spins. There's a twist here by this quadratic residue symbol, alpha over beta, sigma inverse. You're still laughing. I mean, something is fishy here. Yeah. No, I worry. Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah. So you see, so there's also plus minus, but that's a minor thing. I don't want to spend time. Plus minus here is corrected by the Hilbert symbol modulo. It places p equal to 2 and infinity. Actually, infinity is not there because alpha and beta are totally positive. But so it really depends on alpha and beta modulo 8. Yeah. So that's easy to control. The plus minus there. But the twist alpha of beta sigma inverse, you know, is the key thing. So it's not multiplicative object, except, now you can see why. If sigma is involution, then I get alpha over beta sigma squared, which is 1 all the time. There's no sign variation here. You see that you can see from here why the involution is out of question here. Pardon me? That's right, yeah, right, yeah. Maybe you could sneak this, John. yeah. Later on, I will show it if time permits. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's the first observation that is vital even to get courage and go and start studying things like that. Otherwise, you know, forget it. Okay. And So suppose that sigma is a generator and then it's larger than equal to 3, then it's not involution, and we'll be applying our favorite tools, method of summing over primes, or this time prime ideals. So we use exclusion inclusion from sieve idea, like, you know, other, you know, combinatorial identities that need to be done, and then it reduces the problem to estimation of some congruent sums, I'll come to it in a moment, and bilinear forms. Right, okay. So let's go into sums over prime ideals. This is just generalization of what we know for rational primes, identities, commutative identities. But you have to be careful because ideas, because you know, because of the conjugate, you know, you can't simply order everything by the norm, because you know, then there are lots of conjugates of an idea, so you have to do a little bit, you know, careful, but not much. You know. Anyway, take my word just that it works, but if you care. So define this von Mangold type function for a general number field. It's logarithm of norm of P if n is a power of prime, I mean L larger than 0, of course, and 0 otherwise. And consider for why, you know, very general problem, excuse me, for a very general problem, sequence A of complex numbers, let's say bounded by 1 for peace of mind, you don't want to have super generality. But general complex numbers, a n, so just indexed by ideals, integral ideals, and all that according to the norm of n. And we study that sum over prime powers of this sequence of norm up to x. And the goal is to estimate this by saving power of x. So tell you just the result in the same time when I introduce the object. So the result will be x to the power 1 minus delta, and with delta 2 theta. This is not delta from the conjecture. This is just some other delta. So, okay. So it depends on estimates, not the estimates for two other objects. So as you know from exclusion-inclusion, this reduces to estimation of this kind of congruence sums. Sum over all ideas, no primes, right? You see, and but divisible by something, right? That's in the Ricci class 0 modulo d, right? And you need the power saving of in this. Let's say, you know, but uniformly in d. Uniformly for every d. So, of course, statistically it's x over d, and I'm claiming over x to 1 minus theta. So, if d is huge, it's a trivial bound. But d could go up to some power of x and still get some useful result. So that's one thing. So this is the concept of such combinatorics, that the sum of the primes is reduced to sum of all with no constraints for n, just all ideals of you know, but divisible by d. But that's not enough. Yeah, and the other one is the estimation of Bellna form. You know, and again you need a non-trivial bound, and also the Bellna form estimation. This is the Bellna form. Two variables. M and n of length up to m and n, and the coefficients are general complex numbers bounded by 1, and this is that what we postulate in the estimation. So for every m and n, so that becomes trivial if m or n is so small, like 1 or 2, like this. So this is really an estimation for a genuine, you know, Bellna form. You know, so you save a little bit if m and n are not both. If they are logarithmically in the logarithmic scale the same order of magnitude. It's interesting that we don't suffer from any kind of lack of flexibility, how large uniformity is needed. Yeah, because we don't care about some exponents, and using very high power Helder, that was sufficient. So we just need non-trivial bound for the congruent sum and non-trivial bound for the Bellna form with some exponents. And if I have these exponents, then we have this estimation with delta being theta over 2 theta. That's a general result, has nothing to do with spin, just simply absolutely general result, you know, from sequence A.
So it seems to me that the Fabry-Riemann hypothesis would follow if you had the second estimate for the
Fabry-Riemann. Yes, exactly. Yeah, but that's wishful thinking, because second one, for multiplicative, would not have a cancellation for general coefficients. That's okay. And now when you come to application, very good remark. But that's exactly where the secret is, why we succeeded, because of non-trivial estimation for Bellna form. Okay. However, in application, an is just the spin of n, and let's see, I assume class number. One in this presentation, okay? Just for the presentation, I mean, you know, nothing, okay? And then we got this result, and this is that is default those exponents here. You know, take my word, that's how we got it. It's very interesting that, I mean, the estimation for the congruence sum here, when there are no constraints for primes, falls into the you know, the terms of Hermite analysis in the field, right? Just they know, yeah, yeah. But and this goes by other standard techniques estimation. What is curious here that in from practice, from our experience over years, estimation of the binary form is the hardest part. That here is actually this is the hardest part. Remember, the spin is a tricky thing. Spin is numerator over denominator in the quadratic symbol, and they are related by Galois action. You know, and controlling this how it is related is a tricky. So we are somehow lucky we find certain trick. I don't show it. You know, how to reduce that something to Berger's estimation. So this is reduced. The verification of this axiom here is reduced to Berger's bound for the character sum when n is equal to 3. And if n is larger than 3, again for character sums, but much shorter. And we couldn't handle that, barely. Actually, you know, with this pretentious analysis, you know, maybe n equal to 4 could be handled. Because we even, then of course, not saving power, of it, but just looking, but still, you know, be happy. You know, right? I mean, we just miss n equal to 4. Yeah, right, yeah. All right? So, but you got the impression what it is. So this is a general result here, you know, for abstract sequence A, you know, in the number field. And if you have postulated these two estimations, this one and this one here, then you get the for Sx. And then you apply it for the situation. You know, but of course, verification of two axioms is the whole thing, and you know, and very hard, of course, very hard, very hard. And again, you know, verification of this one was surprisingly the hardest of all. I mean, really hard, very hard. I mean, you know, lots of problems about, you know, degree one ideals. Those who speak completely, those who don't speak completely, blah blah blah, zillions of things. You know, you know, it was very quick to guess, but when it came to realization, it takes months, you know, to fix things properly. Like that just yeah, you know, the at some point, you know, you yeah, of course, the reciprocity law is the absolutely the vital element in this. In these things, and because of Hilbert's symbol in it, and then we didn't define for even denominators, so going around that was very tricky stuff. But we did, yeah. Okay, yeah. All right. Anyway, so that's the result in general. Let me now. I still have some time, right? Say something about. Oh, goodness. Yeah, this is the problem. This is the way?
The
other way. The orientation in the mirror, maybe. Like this. Can you see me?
Maybe. Well, it's probably okay,
yeah.
Actually, but you can turn the microphone.
A little bit here, to my. Yeah. Okay.
I think that looks pretty.
Okay.
Comfortable?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, thanks, yeah. All right, so let's, because, of, I mean, we are here on the number theory, so we know that stuff about, you know, how to estimate sums over primes and other things. I don't spend much time on it, even though it is, in details, it is pretty, pretty, you know, fragile, you know, thing. Anyway, let's go back to the spin. And let's see what happens. Suppose now that we consider now again back to sigma to be an involution. What happens there? Okay, when sigma in the Galois automorphism, you know, is an involution, you know, and so for example, if K is a quadratic extension, then everything is involution. So there will be no theorem for this from the previous. Case. So, and assume the same for peace of mind that U plus is U square and take sigma to be an involution, then let L be the subfield fixed by sigma. So K over L is a relative quadratic extension. Yeah. And let B be the discriminant. There's a little bit tricky thing. This is relative extension. If L is Q, then it is more familiar. But if it's not, then there's a little bit of gymnastic to define things. So D is the discriminant. It's an ideal. That's not a number. K over L, and assume it's odd. Okay. And just for simplicity, D is odd. Okay. So here is the proposition which gives you exact, you know, characterization, at least in some cases, of the spin in terms of a character, or almost a character, you know. So you have, So alpha is an integer. Now because I'm playing with two fields, K and L, K is the same as before, and L is a subfield, you know, I better display the dependence of the symbol from the field, because this is very... very sensitive. If alpha is the element of our ring of integers of K, and prime of alpha sigma, totally positive and congruent to 1 mod 8, that's for convenience, I just assume congruent to 1 mod 8, you know, then the spin of the principal ideal is equal to beta over D. Now, this is a quadratic residue symbol. Gosh, what am I doing? Yeah, this is the one. Yeah. Quadratic residue symbol in respect to the field L, not K, subfield, right? Beta over D. D is a fixed, this is the discriminant of the extension, but beta is essentially the trace of alpha, the relative trace of alpha. So it's almost like a character. It's not a character, but almost like that. So you can imagine now, in this case, of course, the spin would be essentially multiplicative, so the technique of Bellna forms and other things would not work. But because of this explicit characterization of the spin, you may try to apply theory of L functions. And indeed, yeah, it works, but then you get traditional standard results for it. So here is the result. If P is a principal prime ideal of K, you know, with this generator, so you need to really, okay, great, okay, fine. Okay, so then the summation over such primes of the spin, depending on sigma, of course, has this, you know, bound from the zero origin Adama de la Valla Poussin type, right? And if you assume Riemann hypothesis, then you have x to 1/2 log x root 1/2. And, you know, you can derive Riemann hypothesis from this, too. Yeah. Which one? Proposition? The proposition, yeah. Indication. It's a very nice, elegant, you know. I can show you from the paper. Actually, you see, I mean, the blackboard. It used the Euler criteria for the definition of the symbol, and for the field and subfield, and then find a relation. If P, yeah, okay. You don't trust me, okay? You do. Okay, and I have to then change notation. The P is in OK, right? And then, I have it lies above something in L, right? Now, I'm sorry, but I use capital P, which is really not traditional for the guy below P. Yeah, yeah. That's why I did it backwards on purpose, because we didn't display the proof, so I didn't need that change of notation. But now he asked, so I have a problem. So P is this P times P sigma, right? Right? Yeah. And then you prove that X over P in K is equal to X over P in L if X is in OL, not OK. And how you prove it? Just take the Euler characterization of the quadratic residue symbol here and in this inverted, and you see it goes. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, so P sigma. Well, P is prime, you know, so it has to be co-prime. Oh, X, yeah. Zero is, yeah, that's right, yeah. But zero is equal to zero, so it's fine. If I write in this way, you don't need that. But I can make you happen, I assume it, if you want, yeah. Right. Okay? Yeah. No, your question is, of course, how you prove this, you know, but this you prove by Euler criteria very easily. Just write the formula for the left and you see the same thing. Yeah. Right. Okay, so, right, so that's the proof of it. And okay, so you have an idea, you know, what's the difference between sigma being involution and sigma being not involution. Like that, you still have a result, but that comes from the traditional zero for region for L functions. You know, even though of course this is not a character here because it's a trace of it, not just alpha, but it behaves almost like, yeah, it's just easy transformation from, you know, to the character sign. Right. Okay, and lots of open questions here about generalizations. You know, we can go generalizations into other and power residue symbols other than quadratic, but that was never really triggered any attention before. But what is the problem is the spin depends on sigma, on the choice of our automorphisms from the Galois group. And let's pay attention to it. So one may ask if I take the whole collection of spins, there'll be n of them, and n is the degree, right? You know, how are they independent? Of course, we already know that for the involution, that's just not the case. So there could be some relation. So, for example, you didn't see that, John. Yeah, right, yeah. Okay, so if you take spin for sigma and A, then it's alpha over alpha sigma by definition, and this one, you can't see by definition that this is in, but it's very easy to prove because it's because of commutativity in the group. Let's say G is, like before, the cyclic group, right? So by commutativity you can prove that the spin of sigma inverse A is alpha sigma over A. But now when you see it together, you know, this is just from the reciprocity law, the same thing, except for this Hilbert symbol. If you multiply them, you just get the Hilbert symbol, which is really easy thing, is modulo, depends on alpha modulo 8. See? So there must be some relation, you know. Okay, so the spin of this is equal to spin of this times the plus minus 1, which depends only on alpha modulo 8 from the Hilbert symbol. For at even places, you know, that you can prove that this is depends on modulo 8. So they are dependent. Similar, more general, if you take a spin for sigma k, sigma is the generator of the group, assuming that the group is still cyclic, and take a spin of n minus k, there will be similar relations. So there are relations between four different sigmas. And the question, open question is, add all these. Are there any other than those obvious natural relations? And we don't know. In particular, if you take n equal to 5, you know, Barry asked question: spin of sigma and spin of sigma square are independent. Studying independent, I mean, can you prove some simultaneous cancellation? You know what I mean? In some statistical way. And never mind even the question, but even if you start, if you make an attempt to prove it, you see the technology fails. The character sums then will be extremely short. If you make a kind of a, you know, a convolution of the spins for different sigmas, you know, the estimation of this Ungren sum still can be transformed into some character sum, but will be impenetrable. You know, it will be not even for a quadratic polynomial as a variable, not for linear. You know, not summing over a segment, and no way. But there are lots of interesting things there to study, I think, you know, about the independence of the spin and analytical, you know, etc. Yeah. And I think I should then say this. Yeah.